Well, hello there. I've got a new gadget. It's one of these wireless microphones. Welcome to Rothley Parish Church. My name's Terry Shepherd, if you don't know it. I'm very grateful that you've come this morning, because I was a bit embarrassed because we picked such an unusual title. And who would possibly want to hear about it? Well, I do. That's why I picked it, because I want to know all about it. This is our fifth annual lecture. Last year we had a professor of astrophysics. This year we got a professor of finance. So, and we're going to find out how the money thing works. I'm very privileged to introduce Dr. Thanasset. I can't pronounce his surname. He comes from Nottingham University, and he's going to help us to understand this obscure topic. Dr. Thanasset.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's a real pleasure to be here to share with you what I know about monetary policy. Okay. During my talk, if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt me and ask away. Okay. So let me start talking about the Bank of England. So the Bank of England is one of the oldest institutions in the UK. It was founded in 1694, so it was about 300 years ago. Its main responsibilities are as follows. Issue banknotes. This should be self-explanatory. It regulates commercial banks. By regulation, we mean it sets the capital requirement for the banks, so the amount of money that the banks or commercial banks need to hold in their account with the Bank of England. It also asks commercial banks to ring fence their activities. So let me explain a little bit. So usually commercial banks take money from depositors, and they can use this money to lend to businesses. But sometimes these commercial banks spend this money or use these monies to invest in some risky activities. So the Bank of England, learning lessons from the financial crisis, told all these banks to ring fence the activities so they can now only use money or their own money to invest in risky assets. They cannot use our money to invest in stock markets, for example. So that's the ring fencing of the capital. The Bank of England also has to maintain stability in the financial markets. In a sense, this is called macroprudential policy. Again, this is something that the Bank of England learned from the recent financial crisis. In around 1990s, commercial banks lend to borrowers to buy houses. Some banks would lend 110% of the value of the house. So it means that not only they bought the houses for you, they also bought the furniture for you as well, because they lent to you more than the value of the house. So the Bank of England now regulates these loan-to-value ratio, so commercial banks can no longer lend to borrowers more than a set value that is specified by the Bank of England. It also tells commercial banks how much money they can lend to borrowers, conditional on the borrower's income, so that it ensures that borrowers can service their debt. Because if borrowers borrow more than they can afford in the future, they cannot actually repay the debt. So this is the one of the duties of the Bank of England. And what I'm going to talk about today is the conduct of monetary policy by the Bank of England. So what is the institutional framework of the Bank of England? So this is written in the Bank of England Act in 1998. So the Bank of England has a duty to maintain price stability, and subject to that, to support the economic policy of Her Majesty's government. So the main duty of the Bank of England is to ensure that the price level is stable. And after it meets this objective, it then has a duty to support economic policy. And by economic policy, we're talking about maintain a low level of unemployment, making sure that the economy grows at a reasonable rate. So what is price stability? Price stability is when ordinary people stop talking or worrying about inflation. Because if prices go up too fast, and if wages don't keep up, we lose the purchasing power. We feel poorer and poorer every day. So the main objective of the Bank of England is to ensure that the price level is stable. In other words, it has to control inflation. So how is inflation created? The textbook says that there are two ways that inflation is created. The first one is what we call the demand pull inflation. And this is, in a sense, quite healthy because for an economy to grow, you will need to have demand. If there is no demand in an economy, nobody buys anything, then the economy will stand still. So a small amount of excess demand, i.e., when there is more demand than what the economy can supply, is a good thing because it keeps the economy going. But too much of it will create inflation. And this is what the Bank of England can control. The supply shocks inflation is coming from the supply side of the economy. This is something that we cannot predict or we cannot control because, for example, if there is a war in the Middle East and there is shortage of oil, then the oil price will go up. That will create inflation, but there's nothing the Bank of England can do because it's outside their control. The only thing that they can do is to control the demand in the economy. So, monetary policy aims to maintain the value of money relative to goods and services that it can purchase, so keep the inflation low. You need tools to do that, but those won't do. So there are three main tools to control inflation. And what I'm going to talk about today is called open market operations. Okay, I'm going to come to that later. The other tools are reserve requirement and discount rate. Okay, so let me explain first what reserve requirement is. When, for example, when you go to a bank, you put £100 in the bank. By law, the bank is required to put a proportion of that money in their account with the Bank of England. This is to prevent bank run. This is to prevent the commercial banks to use the money in other activities. When the reserve requirement goes up, the commercial bank will have to put a larger proportion of the money with the Bank of England, so it has a smaller amount of money to lend. So as you can imagine, if the Bank of England wants to contract the amount of money in the system, it will require the commercial bank to put more money in their account with the Bank of England. If the Bank of England wants the money or more money to be circulated in the system, it will lower the reserve requirement ratio. So this is one of the ways that the Bank of England can control the amount of money that is circulated in the system. Yes, of course. Exactly. Across all banks. At the moment, the reserve ratio is not set. Banks can leave their money with the Bank of England voluntarily. You know, it's the amount is up to them. But because the interest rates are very low at the moment, there is no incentive for commercial banks to leave the money to stand still or to stay still in the account with the Bank of England. The other two is the discount rate. This is more like emergency facility. So by the end of the day, for example, if a commercial bank finds itself short of fund, it will go to the Bank of England to borrow to cover that shortfall. And the Bank of England can charge the interest on that loan. This facility is very expensive, so commercial banks tend not to use it. So basically, it can influence the interest rate in the market by charging the interest on the discount loan. If it wants to encourage commercial banks to borrow from it, it will lower the discount rate. If it wants the commercial bank to not to borrow from it, it will increase the discount rate. So in this way, it can influence the amount of money in the banking system. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about the history of UK monetary policy. So in the 1948 until 1971, the UK participated in the Bretton Woods system. So this system fixed the currencies of 32 member states with the US dollar. And in turn, the US dollar is fixed to gold. So that's why we call it the gold standard. They believe in that time that if you control the amount of gold in the system, the currency would be stable and you would not have inflation. But because of the impossible trinity, this is a concept in economics. If you want to have an independent monetary policy, so if you want to control your own monetary policy, if you want to fix the exchange rate, you cannot control the capital that comes in and out of the economy. If you want to control the capital that comes in and out of the economy, and if you want to have the independent monetary policy, you cannot control the exchange rate. You have to give up one thing. Because the exchange rate was fixed, because we had independent monetary policy back then, so we had a problem with capital flows. And as a result, the sterling or the pound sterling was devalued very sharply. So the gold standard collapsed. After that, we had the floating exchange rate regime. This is more like no plan at all. There was no framework, anything to do with monetary policy, because there was nothing better back then. So they decided to use the floating exchange rate policy. So it was quite a short period of time, about 5 years, before things went wrong again. And then, a couple of years later, there was a thinking by an American economist called Milton Friedman. He suggested that if you can control the money supply that is circulated in the economy, you can then control inflation. So by implication, you make sure that the amount of money supply grows at a steady rate and the inflation will stay steady or will stay constant. So that's why the Bank of England adopted monetary targets. But that period coincided with financial innovation. The main innovation was credit cards. And even though you can control money supply, we know how to control it. They knew how to control it. The speed at which this money circulated in the economy was very unpredictable. because of this financial innovation. So as a result, the money target was missed most of the time. And again, we experienced high inflation, over 10% at some point during the 1970s. Yeah, I wasn't born back then, so I'm not quite sure. And after that, the UK participated in the exchange rate targeting. So at that point, it was called the exchange rate mechanism. We fixed the value of the pound to Deutschmark, so around 3 Deutschmark per 1 pound. And because of the impossible trinity, again, we have the balance of payment problem, because we try to fix the exchange rate to a currency. We also try to be independent in terms of monetary policy, so we had a problem with capital flows again. So the whole thing collapsed once more. And finally, in around 1992, economists learned all this lesson. They came up with a new framework of monetary policy, and they call it inflation targeting. And this is the framework that we have been using since. So between 1992 and 1997, we had what they call inflation targeting before the Bank of England was granted independence. And then in 1997, the Bank of England was granted independence from the government. And this is the kind of inflation targeting framework that we have been using since then. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about inflation targeting. So inflation targeting consists of three main characteristics. The first one is independence. Why being independent is important? It's because governments have an incentive to lower the interest rate or to create inflation. The reason is, if you imagine you borrow £100 today, and if the inflation is very high, so the price level goes up very quickly, that £100 is going to lose its value very quickly. So by the end of, say, 5 years, £100 is nothing. So the government is trying to inflate the debt away. So the research suggests that they're trying to maintain the low level of interest rates so that inflation is high and it doesn't act in the best interest of the entire nation. So that is why independence is quite important. Yes?
But exchange rates are very low. Not exchange rates, the interest rates.
That is because of many other factors that came into force after, for example, the financial crisis and also Brexit. I promised to myself that I wouldn't say this word today, but right. So inflation targeting, the first thing that we need to have is independence from the government. The next characteristic of inflation targeting is transparency. By transparency, we mean the central bank needs an explicit target of inflation. So at the moment, the target is 2% as measured by the consumer price index. Okay. The Bank of England publishes inflation report quarterly, and this is a way of the bank, or a way for the bank to communicate with the public of what they think about the state of the economy. It publishes minutes of the Monetary Policy Committee meetings after each meeting. And also, you can see their voting records anytime on their website. I'm going to talk about this more later. So the idea is to tell the public that this is what we want to do, this is what we think about the economy, this is how we think the interest rate will be, so that the public will be able to plan their business or you know, whatever they want to do accordingly. And finally, another characteristic of inflation targeting is accountability. So if the target is missed by 1% on each side of the target, so if the inflation rate is more than 3% or if it's below 1%, the governor is required to write a letter to the chancellor explaining why the target has been missed and what actions the bank will take in order to bring the target back to 2%. Okay, so these are the three characteristics of inflation targeting. So let's have a look at this chart. This is the first picture I'd like to show you. This is called the inflation fan chart. So we are here at this point, around 2019. So this is the projection of the inflation rate in the next 3 years. The darker shade shows the range of inflation with the highest possibility. So as the shade gets lighter and lighter, the possibility of inflation going up or down away from the target is smaller and smaller. So it doesn't tell you precisely what the inflation will be, but it tells you a range of inflation over the next 3 years. The lighter the shade, the smaller the probability of that inflation rate. So if you look at this plot, you can see that actually the inflation is predicted to stay on the target at 2% over the next 3 years, provided that nothing changes between now and the next 3 years, which is impossible.
Yes.
Right. But this is what the economic models that the Bank of England use tell them or tell us. So inflation targeting, has it been successful? Well, in a sense it has, because the first country that adopted inflation targeting, I don't think you can see the New Zealand. Yes, very good. really good eyesight. So it adopted inflation targeting in 1990, so at this point. Since then, the inflation rate has gone down substantially and stays around 2% until even today. The next country that adopted inflation targeting is Canada. And again, you can see that after the adoption, the inflation rate dropped to around 2%, which is the target, and stays there. And the UK, again, the inflation rate has stayed at 2% since the adoption. On this side of the slide, you can see that these are the plots showing the level of inflation and the year of the adoption. To give you an example, New Zealand adopted inflation targeting in 1990. At the moment, the inflation rate is around 4%. Canada adopted in around 1991, the inflation rate is around 5%. The UK adopted the inflation targeting in 1992, the inflation rate at the moment stays around 2%. Some countries adopted the framework very late. For example, Serbia adopted the inflation targeting in 2009, but the inflation rate still stayed at around 7%. So it looks like there's a wide range of outcome for the inflation targeting framework. Some countries seem to be doing very well, and some countries seem to be doing worse. And these, according to the research, suggest that it's not the inflation targeting that is a problem. It's the institutional framework that is the problem. It's the credibility of the central bank that is the problem. Because if you look at this plot again more carefully, you can see that the red dots, which represent developing countries, seem to be doing either very good or very bad. Whereas the blue dots, which represent developed countries, seem to be doing okay. So central banks with more disciplines seem to be able to control inflation better. Yes.
There don't seem to be countries that I might expect, like USA or China.
Well, the USA is not an inflation targeter. No, I mean, they never announced that they are inflation-targeting country. But actually, implicitly, they are. But they never said, you know, explicitly that they are inflation-targeter. China is not also, is not an inflation-targeter. So these are the countries that announced to the world that, look, we are targeting inflation explicitly. Now, so how do you control inflation? When demand outstrips supply, so if there is more demand pressure in the economy, then usually companies will raise prices, and this will lead to inflationary pressure, so general prices will go up. So in order for the Bank of England to control inflation, it will raise the interest rate. It's very simple. Inflation goes up, interest rate goes up. The inflation goes down, interest rate goes down. When the Bank of England raises its bank rate, which is the main interest rate that the Bank of England uses to control inflation, we call this action contractionary or tightening of monetary policy. Depending on how this change passes through the economy. Because if you think about it, even if the Bank of England raises the interest rate, commercial banks do not have to do the same. Especially the rate that commercial banks pay depositors usually tend to go up very slowly. They don't want to raise the rate that they pay you. But once the interest rate set by the Bank of England goes up, borrowers pay more quite immediately. So the pass-through is not always perfect. Sometimes it takes time for commercial banks to change its rates that they charge the borrowers or the rates that they give to the the depositors. So when the interest rate goes up, then it is more attractive to save than to spend. Because it's, you know, you're going to get higher return when you put the money in the bank. And for companies, it will be more expensive to borrow. That will slow things down because when consumers find it more attractive to save, then they don't spend the money. If firms feel that it's more expensive to borrow, they don't want to invest. And another impact of a rise in the interest rate is to make the pound stronger. Because money goes where it gets most return. So if the interest rate on the pound sterling goes up, then the exchange rate of the pound sterling will go up as well. So export will be more expensive and import will be cheaper. And that will slow down the economy as well. If the bank cuts the interest rate, we call this action expansionary easing or loosening. So these are the terms that you might find in newspapers. Okay. So how does all these changes affect inflation? The change in the official rate or the bank rate will affect inflation in through various channels. We call these channels transmission mechanisms of monetary policy. When the market rates go up, more attractive to save, less attractive to spend money, more attractive to invest. Sorry, let me repeat myself again. When interest rate goes up, it is more attractive to save, less attractive to spend money. Firms will find it too expensive to borrow, so they will not invest as much as they want to. And that will impact the domestic demand, and then eventually will bring down the price pressure. If the interest rate goes up, usually stock markets will do worse. And this is how the financial markets and the economy are interacting. So if the interest rate goes down, the stock markets are doing well. And this is what we observed during the past 15 years. The interest rate has been very low for a very long time. If you invested in the stock market 15 years ago, you would have earned a lot of money. Okay? So it will affect the asset prices, and eventually, via what we call the wealth effect, it will affect inflation. What is the wealth effect? If you own a lot of shares, a lot of bonds, for example, when the values of these assets goes up, you feel more wealthy. And when you feel that, you go out and spend more. If the value of shares or bonds goes down, you feel poorer and you will spend less as a result. This is what the theory suggests. The change in the official rate also affects expectation or confidence. So if you know that the Bank of England has your back, by stimulating the economy, you feel more confident in investing in businesses or, go out there and spend, and then that will affect your demand as well. And finally, as I said earlier, a change in the bank rate will affect the exchange rate, and then it will eventually affect the inflation.
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
Do you think we're creating an asset bubble now by...
In a sense, we are, because...
So there will be a crash later on?
I don't think there will... The Bank of England or the Federal Reserve will try their best not to crash the asset markets. Mm-hmm. Because at the moment, if you look back 3 or 4 months ago, the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of America, they were talking about raising the federal funds rate. As soon as they started talking about that, the stock market went down really sharply. And Donald Trump came out and said, look, you can't do that. You need to keep the rate low. And the stock market started to go up. So they are now in a big dilemma. Because in a sense, they want to raise interest rate because the interest rate is so low at the moment. But as soon as they think about it or start talking about it, the stock markets react to that news. Right. So the conduct of monetary policy is done by these people, 9 people in total. We call this group of people the Monetary Policy Committee, the MPCs. It consists of 5 internal members. So these 5 people work at the Bank of England, and we've got 4 external members appointed by the Chancellor. 2 of them, these 2 people, are professors at London School of Economics and London Business School. And the other 2 external members are business owners. Okay. So these people will meet at least once a month to talk about the state of the economy. They will look at data provided to them by the Bank of England's analysts, and then they will deliberate for 2 days, and then by the end of the 2 days, they will make a decision on the interest rate, which is then announced to the market immediately. So how do you go from the interest rate decision to the open market operations? So the bank has to change the market rate so that change will pass through to the commercial banks, to consumers, to borrowers. So how does the bank affect the market interest rates? They use what we call open market operations. So this operation focuses on short-term interest rates. At the end of every day, at the end of each day, commercial banks, some of them will find themselves have more money than they want. Some of them will find themselves have less money than they want, so they have shortfalls. So they will lend and borrow to each other. They can also come to the Bank of England and borrow from the Bank of England. But the Bank of England doesn't just lend them money. It needs collateral. So in order to lend these institutions money, they use a facility called the repurchase agreement, the sale and the repurchase agreement. So the commercial bank comes to the Bank of England, sells assets to the bank, get the money. And then 2 weeks later, this bank goes back to the Bank of England, buy the assets back, and return the money to the Bank of England. So these assets are either the treasury bills or the UK government foreign currency debt or any low-risk instruments. The difference between the selling price and the buying price is the interest. So to give you some example, suppose I'm HSBC. I need £100 today. I can't borrow it from other banks. So I go to the Bank of England. I said, I want to sell you this bond today for £100. And then 2 weeks later, I come back to you, and then I buy it back at £101. So the difference of £1 for 2 weeks is the interest. So the interest rate on this transaction is 1%, but for 2 weeks. So for 1 year, it's 26%. So this is how the Bank of England affects the market rates of interest. It will charge the banks that come to use the repo facility the interest rate on the purchase and the sale of government securities.
Okay.
Yes?
That bond,
yeah,
that it gives over, is it an existing bond?
Yes. No, you can't. I mean, you can't invent the bonds, because these bonds, these banks probably at some point have bought these bonds from the government as an investment, because these bonds are not liquid. They're not money. So it's just investment. If they want money, they have to sell them to the Bank of England, get the money to use for 2 weeks, and then buy them back. Okay? So that's how the Bank of England affects the market rates of interest. So this is what I just talked about earlier. Today, HSBC sells the assets to the Bank of England and gets cash. 2 weeks later, goes back to the bank, returns the cash, get the assets back. Very simple. Sounds easy? Well, not quite, because a change in the interest rate today will take a long time before it impacts the inflation rate. So research suggests that it takes 1 year for a change in the interest rate today to affect the demand in the economy, and another year for the change to affect inflation. It's not like driving a sport car down A46 where, you know, you get a long straight road and you can just avoid any obstacle very quickly. It's more like trying to navigate in an oil tanker in a foggy weather, trying to avoid all the icebergs. You have to really look ahead of what you want to do. And that's how monetary policy works. It takes time for any change to impact the inflation. And also, there's a short-run trade-off between unemployment and inflation, because if you want to control inflation, you have to sacrifice the growth. The economy will be contracted if you want to slow the inflation down. If you want to stimulate the economy by lower the unemployment rate, you have to accept inflation later. So this is the trade-off between inflation and unemployment. There could be unintended consequences. For example, a rise in the interest rate today will affect borrower and also lenders. And sometimes savers will be will suffer more than borrowers. For example, I'm sure you know, you don't borrow much anymore. You tend to save, and you know, the longer period of low interest actually is not working in your favor at all. Yeah. And finally, we don't know how effective policy is. Sometimes there is also uncertainty about the impact of the policy. Is it too much? Is it too little? Do we need to reduce the rate more, or do we need to raise it more than we want? Because we don't know whether it will be effective in the long run. So that brings me to talk about a very popular topic these days, quantitative easing. Okay, so far what I have been talking about is what we call conventional monetary policy. So it's the kind of policy that we use in normal times. But in abnormal times, conventional monetary policy doesn't work very well. And the reason is that because at the moment, the interest rate is near zero. The Bank of England could lower the interest rate more, but if it hits zero, it has nowhere to go. If it goes further, it will be negative. And the consequence of having a negative interest rate is unknown. Because would you pay the bank to keep your money? Right? I would rather put the money under my mattress instead of paying the interest to the bank to keep my money. So in order to expand the economy further, central banks use unconventional monetary policy. So one of them is called quantitative easing. And the idea is to injecting money directly into the economy. So flood the entire economy with money. So how does a central bank do that? Well, it has unlimited firepower when it comes to creating money. It simply put more zeros in its own account and then use that extra money to buy government bonds. That's it. It doesn't have to print money anymore because these days everything is done electronically. So it just keeps adding zero to its own account and then buy government bonds, corporate bonds, using those extra money. So the impact is pretty much similar to the impact of conventional monetary policy, because once the money is out there, then banks will need to find the use of the money by lending more to businesses, lending more to consumers. And hopefully businesses will invest more, consumers will buy more, in order, and that as a result, the economy will be stimulated. It also works via the wealth effect as well, because when monies are injected directly into the economy, banks will buy assets like stocks and shares, pushing up share prices. And as a result, those people who own shares will feel more wealthy and then hopefully will spend more money on other things. So this is how quantitative easing works. So between March 2009 and September 2012, the Bank of England created £350 billion of new money. So that's a lot of zeros.
It all went to banks, etc. In actual fact, it's, you know, thousands of pounds per person could better spend going to the ordinary people.
So how do you propose, like, you know, drop the monies around and then...
Yes.
Well, that...
It would have created far more demand, for instance.
But then...
Than the asset bubble.
But if you think about it, suppose that... Okay, let me give you an example. Suppose that everybody in this room wants to buy this thing. Yeah? Let's say it's £10. Yes? If I just give everybody £100 today... Right now, The only thing that will change is that this thing is going to cost more. Because everybody will say, okay, I've got 100 pounds. I can pay more. The next person will say, I've got 100 pounds as well. I can also pay more for this thing. So the consequence will be inflation. It will not produce any change.
Sure it would.
Yeah? Maybe. Right. So let me go back to what quantitative easing did. So between March 2009 and September 2012, the Bank of England created a huge amount of new money. So as a consequence, money found its way to the stock markets, to the bond markets. Share prices went up substantially. But if you think about it, it's wealthy people who own shares, not ordinary people. Ordinary workers, they don't own shares or bonds. So as a consequence, the only thing that the quantitative easing did so far is increase inequality. Because normal workers do not feel or haven't felt the impact of this stimulus. And in 2012, we saw negative growth in lending, so there was not much lending happening. So the UK entered a double-dip recession in 2012. So the impact of the quantitative easing wasn't what we would call a success. But if the Bank of England didn't embark on the quantitative easing program, things could have been worse, but we will never know because we don't have the counterfactual world to compare it with. So where we are at the moment, the interest rate is now 0.75%, still very low. It went down from 5% just after the financial crisis, quickly to 0.5%. Then after the EU referendum, it went down to 0.25%. And then the bank started to increase the bank rate 2 years later. And my thought is that the reason that the Bank of England raises the interest rate is that it wants to be able to lower it again in the future. Because the rate was too low, at some point it had to go up. And when it saw that inflation actually took off after the referendum, then it raises the interest rate. So inflation is now going back towards the target. And if you notice, this is when the referendum occurred. The inflation started to go up, and it jumped quite quickly. And the reason is because the weakness of the pound. The pound went down from $1.5 per £1 to 1.25 at one point. So imports became quite expensive, and that is why inflation jumped quite quickly during the 2 years after the referendum. At the moment, investment is not looking good because the recent data, we saw that the business invested less, so it's actually lower than previous quarter. Good news is that wage started to grow more quickly, so people will feel less poor when wage starts to catch up with the inflation rate. So I will finish my lecture with what I think is going to happen in the future. It may not be the most accurate prediction, but as an economist, I like to predict something. The first problem that I can see is that there will be no room for maneuver for the Bank of England because the interest rate is now very low, 0.75%. if it cuts the rates again, it would go to 0.5 and then 0.25, and that's the limit. The amount of money that it created during the last 10 years is phenomenal. So it's really huge. And I don't think it will want to create more money to buy government bonds. So monetary policy will have very little impact on economy looking forward. Another problem that I think is going to come out is that because of the lower rates that we have had for so long, the amount of unsecured debt has grown very sharply. So at the moment, it grows by almost £80 million a day. This is the fastest rate of growth for 15 years. And these debts consist of car finance, credit cards, overdrafts, and student debts, you know, the majority of them anyway. So at some point, the borrowers will have to repay these debts. And the Bank of England is going to be reluctant to raise the interest rate, because if the interest rate goes up, the ability of these borrowers to repay will be hampered. And finally, this is an idea proposed by an economist in the US, Lawrence Summer. He suggests that actually the developed economies have been in recession for a long, long time. That is why the interest rate has started to fall very sharply during the last few years. So the demand in the developed economies have been very weak. Monetary policy has been ineffective in stimulating the economy. And people are starting to pay down debt. And by paying down debt instead of spending, it would not get the economy going. So this is what we call the balance sheet recession. Everybody is trying to pay down debt, and instead of spending money on something that will stimulate the economy, you know, it's been spent to reduce the amount of debt. So monetary policy will not be able to do something to stimulate growth. Okay, so that's what I wanted to talk about today.
Well, perhaps we should stop the formal questions there. I'm sure Dr. Thanasset will be having a cup of coffee, and if you go and gather around him, you can bend his ear, no doubt. I've been sitting here absolutely smock-raveled. It's an incredibly new thing for me to listen to someone like this undoing and unpicking the wonders of the world of finance and banking. I hope you feel the same, and you'll give him a really good thank you with your hands.
Thank you.